What else do we need to consider, and we're back on tape, in looking at this career, and maybe also thinking about how Sam's political philosophy, using that term, changed, and but also how your thinking has changed over the years.
Well, I think it's sort of interesting that we never talked about politics at all before we got married. I didn't know what Sam was, and I was recruiting in Eugene, and the walls were very thin, and I couldn't help hearing a newlywed couple just finding out that one was a Republican and the other was a Democrat, and they were screaming at each other about how unfair, why didn't you tell me? It was absolutely unfair of you to say nothing. And that's when I said to Sam, you know, we're both in the service, and we're supposed to be apolitical anyhow, you know. What are you, incidentally? And found out we were both Republicans, and but came out of completely different kind of backgrounds, and so we didn't say that much about it. And then when I began to recognize that in Oregon, a person could make a difference, an individual could make a difference. In Ohio, I don't think it would have been easy to persuade one that one person would make a difference. In fact, I don't think people in Ohio could even have told you who their state representative was or their state senator, except when that came around to election time. And people didn't have to campaign very hard in those days. They could get elected pretty easily, and you just weren't aware of it. But here I was out there then in Oregon, and I was aware of it during the Navy, but not actively involved, of course, at all. And then there we were out in Redmond, and realized that almost everything was political. And when you had a candidate for the President of the United States standing on the high school lawn talking to a group of people, and some of them were bringing him a salmon or bringing him a piece of venison or something, and this was a man who was running for the President of the United States, you recognize that Oregon was a state where an individual could make a difference. And then Sam was not involved actively in politics at all, except as his father knew senators or representatives or went back to Washington, knew members of the cabinet, and so on. And Sam would meet some of these people in the summertime at that Bohemian encampment, notably President Hoover. And then when I found out that President Hoover, who was always a hero of mine, really, and his wife particularly, and that he was a hero to Senator Hatfield, I think that's what drew me to Mark Hatfield to a certain extent. And so, and then to have the Republican National Committee man living in Redmond. And I remember when Wayne Morse was running for the Senate, and he was preaching his constitutional liberalism, and I was trying to translate that to my mother, who was pretty much a conservative Republican from way back, convinced Republican. She said, "Elizabeth, that won't sell. That's not, you can't do that, even though you think you can. Eventually, that won't work." And embracing it is kind of, from your point of view, maybe short-sighted. Well, it still didn't seem short-sighted to me. I was a strong supporter of
constitutional liberalism, meaning?
Well, that you could be a liberal and still abide by the strict interpretation of the Constitution, and that it was big government invading and still going by the Constitution, but you should turn to government for a lot of what should be, from my mother's point of view, private responsibility.
But it was appealing to you at the time.
It was appealing to me at the time. And trying to battle my mother made me realize that maybe I hadn't looked at it that closely. And then I was sort of carried away with the power of speaking and what it could do to convince people. And I remember when Wayne Morse was in trouble for one thing or another, and he had come back to the Redmond High School to a town meeting, and there were lots of people there. And afterwards, we all went out to Jim Short's house, and Morse called up. And Jim said, I don't know anybody, Wayne, who can lose more people when he's away from where they are. and get them all back if he talks to them, and if they think black is white and you convince him that it isn't, they'll go away thinking it's kind of gray, and all I can tell you is keep coming back. And so I guess that's what kind of interested me. And then when I got on the Redmond School Board, and it was no trick to get elected to Redmond School Board in those days, and you realize that here was a small town school where the superintendent knew all the teachers, knew all the kids, knew their families, and being on a school board was really fun, and you could see children accomplishing things, and families being content with their schools, made me continue to be interested in what children were learning, not who they were, not the condition of their district or their parents' economic conditions. And I guess that related back to my depression days when everybody was poor and when we were all convinced that with a good education, you could open doors. And my father constantly saying to us during the Depression, you've got to get a good education because what you have in your head, they cannot take away from you. And you can make that work for you in many good ways. So that was my motivation for being on a school board, was constantly to think about what children were learning, how they were learning to live together, and that sort of thing. That got me over to the legislature, and that made me realize that you've got to keep in touch with your state representatives. So I knew those people in a way that Sam didn't, because he didn't go to the legislature. He'd write letters to the editor, to Bob Chandler, expressing some of his political views, and why did Bob Chandler take on an issue like gun control? Sam violently differed from Bob Chandler on gun control and a number of other issues. And then when Sam was thinking of running for the legislature, and he was kind of involved in finding a candidate, and then when he got involved, and I had been unelected from the Redmond School Board because in 1965, our number one daughter had to enter high school. Mm-hmm. And Sam and I had both said to each other, they'd fired another superintendent in Redmond. It was a very unstable district, has been, right straight along, and you don't know why. Mm-hmm. But they didn't teach foreign languages, they didn't teach math, and when they fired the superintendent, there went the Latin teacher, so there wasn't going to be any Latin. The best math teacher went to Eugene, and Sam and I both said, here's Betsy, big student activist, president of the student body. She'll schmeichel her way through school. She's bright. She's no genius, but she's bright. And she'll graduate with straight A's, and she won't know sic'em. Do we dare let that happen to her? And both of us decided we didn't. And so then we didn't want her to be out of the state. St. Helens Hall was the only boarding school in the state. Betsy did not want to go. She really hated it. She kept referring to it as that place, and get me out of that place. And she wouldn't even talk with me about buying uniforms to enter. And it was inexorable. We were moving right toward entry day. And she wouldn't even talk about it. But Sam and I both lived long enough to have both girls, both of whom graduated from St. Helens Hall, say to us, thank you, thank you, thank you for giving us that kind of an education, which just helped us in 100 ways. And Betsy majored in history, had a wonderful history teacher who opened up vistas to her that would never have happened someplace else. And there was no question about it. You had to do it. And living in a dormitory, you had to live by the rules. And it was right when all the psychedelic stuff and marijuana started hitting the schools. And it was tough for all students and all parents to do it. But she made it, and she graduated president of the student body at St. Helens Hall, too. So, and as she said, I not only wouldn't have been able to get into Carleton College or a Carleton College, I wouldn't have been able to stay.
Now, how did you pick Carleton?
Well, she had a list of the 27 most highly selective institutions, and her teachers at St. Helens Hall kept telling her it's highly unlikely that you'll get admitted to any of those, so you've got to pick some others. And Sam did not want her to go to Berkeley or to Stanford, even if she could get in, because those were two big graduate schools, and he thought freshmen didn't have a chance at those great big, you know, just hotbeds of comings and goings that could cut freshmen, especially non-resident people. He always had his house that he could go to in Berkeley. But at any rate, the only two schools that, so Betsy took that list of 27, and we just decided which ones it would make sense to apply to, and Carleton was one of them. It was right at the time Harvard and Yale were opening up to women, and neither one of us wanted her to go to either one of those places if she could get in, because there's no point in being a guinea pig. I wasn't all that thrilled with Harvard and Yale, and she didn't want to go to another girls' school, so that eliminated the Wellesleys and the Smiths and so on. And so she was accepted at every place she applied except Pomona and Stanford. And so then Sam's family had all come from Wisconsin. We thought it was a good idea to have her go someplace else instead of just all in Oregon. Mm-hmm. And so that's why we just picked Carleton.
It sounds like you had ambitions to get your daughters into the best schools that you could manage.
Well, we did, but when number two daughter came along and didn't want to go to college at all, she was just as academically able as Betsy was, but not academically inclined, and she knew she wanted to be a nurse. And I had tried so hard to save those diploma schools that were in hospitals like Emmanuel and Good Samaritan and Sacred Heart, and they were wonderful nurse training schools. And fortunately, Patty just marched right from high school out to Emmanuel, and that's where she got her nurse's training. And she had to take some college courses, but they were offered by Portland Community College, and they were brought to the nursing school. They didn't have to go to the campus, but they saw a reason for studying. She'd had all the chemistry and math and all that sort of thing, and she said her Latin helped her no end in a nurse's training, but she'd study sociology, psychology, some of the theories of nursing and history of nursing and so forth from Portland Community College. So she has a few credits, but that's all she has. So she never got a degree. And I think had she gone to the University of Oregon and then with the idea of going on to the nursing school up there where you had to have 2 years of college before you could enter their degree program, or even their diploma program up there, she would have just not done it. She was just a different kind of person. She was a more reserved person. She wasn't outgoing and aggressive the way Betsy was. She was more an introvert. That it was wonderful that she had the kind of education, though, that she appreciated at St. Helens Hall, and that made nursing education really much easier for her. And then she specialized in intensive care, and she was trying to nurse and fly at the same time because she was infected with the flying bug, and their instructor from Redmond had them qualify for every rating, multi-engine and all the rest of that. And she was thinking of a career in aviation, as well as flying, but she was nursing at night and flying in the daytime, and you couldn't do both of them successfully. And so finally she just quit the nursing, and she became an international competitor in aerobatic flying.
Such a remarkable turn. You must have been very surprised when you saw her.
Well, I was. I really was. Never intended even thought that she'd make aviation. And right now she never went back to nursing. After she got into it, she stopped the international competition on an amateur basis, and she's teaching aerobatics she's independent, but she's close enough to a flying school called Emory down in Florida, and they have to take aerobatic flying as part of their flight instruction, and so she has some private students, including a number of foreign students right at the moment. And she's still flying, though she's racing. And last summer, when my brother was so desperately ill, and it was hard to get in touch with Patty, and all I was told is she's in Reno, and I kept saying, what's she doing in Reno? And they'd all say, oh, well, she's looking at gliders, and she's taking up gliding, and that sort of stuff. And I said, why doesn't she call us more often? Then here I found out she was in racing with these aerobatic planes, and she came in second, and it was national racing things, and that's what she was doing. So she had to be in Reno practicing all the time in order to qualify. Mm-hmm. And you had to qualify just as you do for the Olympics or anything. If you don't do it well enough, they don't let you even qualify to race.
When you were raising your two daughters, what sort of purposes did you have? What did you really want to instill in them?
I don't know. Sam just simply said, you know, with communism out there as a threat always, and with anarchy, if we tear ourselves apart internally, and he was very concerned way then, and he'd be even more concerned now, that just as Arthur Schlesinger has written in a recent essay that's turned into a book, the disuniting of America, because we are divided into so many competing special interest groups, and we're tearing ourselves apart, and we're calling ourselves Afro-Americans, Italian-Americans, German-Americans, and everything. Back when this country was started and in its days of strength, we were Americans first, last, and always. We still kept our interest in maybe in our old world ties if we were immigrants, but if we were second generation or third generation immigrants, we knew that our forebears came from England or Germany or at Italy or France, but we didn't think of ourselves as hyphenated anything, and that was the great strength. The melting pot theory was the great strength of this country, and now we're just breaking ourselves into these little groups that tear at each other all the time, and don't take pride in the fact that we're Americans. And yet you couldn't convince very many people who do that. And they do it from a political power base in many instances, that they should be deprived of their American citizenship. Go back to Africa, or go back to Russia, or go back to Germany. If you want to, they wouldn't do that. And many of the blacks, you know, I was there with the evolution from Negroes, which is what they really were when I went to school. They were Negroes. Then they insisted to be called blacks. And that was all right, but it didn't fit a lot of them either. And there was not unanimity in that. And now all of a sudden they're African Americans. And I ask you, many of those people have no connection with Africa at all. No more than I do with Germany, or you do with Scotland, or wherever you came from, Ireland. And so he just decries what's happening to this country. And Sam would have been, I think, even though he might have differed from Arthur Schlesinger Jr. in political philosophy, he would have been certainly with him in that fear. Uh-huh. That we're hurting ourselves and not united in many ways in what we want to do, and that politicians appeal then to special interests, and whoever has the most power and most votes.
One other thing that I really want to ask you, and that is the thinking of yourself and this narrative, really shows you, it really portrays you as a public person.
A private person.
What do you think of the concept of being a public
person? Well, it's kind of interesting, because Sam and I were older when we got married. Sam was 33, I was 31. And we didn't have any children for 6 years. I was 37 when Betsy was born. And we were kind of resigned to the fact that we weren't going to have any children, and we were going to be sad if we didn't. But on the other hand, when we had Betsy, she was the most wonderful thing that ever happened in the whole wide world. But I really believed I must be the oldest mother. My mother had always said, don't wait till you were as old as I was to have your first child. She was 28. So I'd gone way beyond that. And people were asking me, was that my grandbaby when I had her in a pram? And Sam was very uncomfortable with little tiny babies. But he loved girls, and he was so glad when Betsy was a girl, partly because he would have felt that if it was a boy, he should be out there hunting and fishing and golfing and doing all that sort of thing. And with his gout, he wouldn't have been able to. But if it was girls, it wasn't bad to have somebody be an instructor and teach them how to do all this thing. And Sam had been a skier, but couldn't any longer ski. But nevertheless, when Betsy was able to start to talk, Sam was the most involved father you could possibly imagine. And he was so proud of her and so urging her, whatever boys can do, you can do just as well, if not better, a heck of a lot better. And so we were with them a great deal of the time. And I stayed home and was there, even though we had a housekeeper. But Sam insisted, and the housekeeper insisted, that they have their share of responsibilities. They each had to make their own beds. They each had to keep their own bedrooms clean. And Sam kept saying to them, when kids began to use such awful language, even in the presence of adults, and play that awful loud, raucous music. You know, anybody can play the awful loud, raucous music, and if you think you're shocking us by using that kind of language, forget it. We know all those words, we've heard them used, but an educated and refined person in the company of adults does not use that kind of language. And I don't care how you talk with your chums, but when you're with our friends, you're behaving like little ladies. If you have to be the best actresses in the world, I don't care, but you better do it, and you better stay with the adults, and you stay at the meals, and you ask to be excused, and you don't act bored. And Betsy found the company of older people always very exciting and interesting, and she reacted to Sam. The two of them had a wonderful relationship, and he really taught her the facts of life more than I did, because he could do it from a very realistic and a very, the thing that he didn't want her and Patty ever to do was something that would get them maimed, injured, or destroyed, or their minds destroyed. And he came at it from that point of view, and self-respect. And you can't have respect for yourself if you don't know who you are. And if you use drugs and alcohol and that sort of stuff, you won't know who you are. I remember one night Patty had a party at our house, and we always had a bar and liquor. And she had these kids over there, and they apparently got swacked. We happened not to be at home, but when we got home, it wasn't hard to recognize that Patty'd been drinking. And so Sam immediately called up the parents of every one of those kids, and we got them together at somebody's house, and Sam acknowledged that it was our fault that that liquor was there and that we hadn't taught Patty that it was there for a purpose, and having kids in and drinking was not the purpose. And so she began to learn, and so did Betsy, that we had a drink. In those days, lots of people smoked. I did too, but not a lot, very rarely, and Sam never smoked cigarettes. That you had to be personally responsible, and that there would be lots of times when you should disengage yourself and just leave, and that's why you have to carry money, and you have to be able to drive a car, and that's what motivated him to have him be able to drive an airplane, so that you're not at the mercy of somebody. You make your own decisions, and you do it, and you know what to do, even though it's a tough situation. Well, at any rate, he was a wonderful parent. Only thing I always thought that he bragged on the ladies in his family too much. He was so, right now, if he'd see Betsy and what she's done and that she was invited to join the Arlington Club and all of that, he wouldn't be able to wear a vest, because Betsy is doing what he kind of hoped she would do someday. And she's doing so much of giving of herself. Sam had a strong philosophy of how fortunate one was to be in the position that we were, but you had an obligation to do what you could to help people who were not so fortunate, or to be able to help plan programs or budgets or whatnot that would make it possible for those who couldn't, and particularly those people who physically were not able, and older people who were not able to take care of themselves. And And so I went along with it, but I remember when the disciplining business came into it, Sam was not very good at disciplining kids, and it got left up to me to do it. In some cases, Sam was very good at disciplining them if it was a matter of they hadn't set the table correctly, or they hadn't done their bedroom very well or something. But I remember during the days of student unrest up at the cabin, and Betsy was there, and she was talking with one of her high school friends, and there was only one telephone in the house. And I just happened to pass by, and I heard her say, "I disagree with her about 90% of the time, but I can tell you one thing, it's good to know where she stands." And that, she was talking about me, obviously, and with a girl whose mother never did give her very much assistance, and the girl flopped around an awful lot. And in the end, Sam always kept saying, you know, if age and experience doesn't count for something, then what can parents do other than try to use their age and experience and whatnot to keep you from repeating the same errors that all people, young people, go through? And it's perfectly all right if you want to say, you know, there is no God and you're going to leave the church and you're not going to go to organize anything, the way a lot of the kids of Betsy's generation did. But hardly anybody faces the inevitable without calling out, "Oh my God." And that means you acknowledge that there's somebody bigger than you are, and maybe you can't relate it to an organized church, but there is something bigger than you are, and you recognize how puny you are, and that you have something to come back to. So he was very cooperative with me in insisting they go to Sunday school. Betsy started in a little private kindergarten when she was only 3 years old, because she was an only child then, and we didn't want her to be all alone. And she had one good little friend in the neighborhood, but that was about all. And we were so much older that, but I became a campfire den mother, and Sam took a big interest in the Boy Scouts right straight along, even though he didn't have, he officiated at every Eagle Scout investiture, I think, when he was in the legislature, that it was physically possible for him to be there. And he kept talking to kids about setting some goals for yourself, even though they may be unrealistic, and you're never going to have a light bulb turn on all of a sudden, you know who you are. That kind of evolves, but you've got to be flexible. You've got to be able to step in if the opportunity presents itself. And you always have to set those goals out there that you're working toward. At least they're there, and they may change, but they're there. And that was the gist of very often what he said. He started, for example, up in Madras, they started a little club called Future Business Leaders. And he gave them some money to buy some stock in some companies, just the little club, to see how the stock exchange worked and to read the Wall Street Journal and see how they would invest money. And if they made money, fine, then you've made it for your group and you can do something and enjoy it. If you lose money, tough, that's the way it is, but you've used some judgment and you know how the world operates and what the free enterprise system would look like if it were carried out ideally, and so on. He also supported very strongly Future Farmers of America, because those kids combine public speaking, influencing legislation, right along with their taking care of farm animals. Supported strongly the 4-H, because he saw those kids taking responsibility for their animals, polishing them up and washing them and getting them ready for showing and all that sort of thing. He just enjoyed young people, and by and large they enjoyed him and they enjoyed us. And I think that one of the things we both have prized is people coming back, you know, and sitting down in the office and talking. And he learned a lot from those kids. And he was on the board at Lewis and Clark during the same time I was on the State Board of Higher Education. And it was all he could do to contain himself sometimes to go to those rap sessions. But as he said, you always learn something. And hopefully they learn something, you're not sure. But at least if you believe that you're supposed to listen to each other, then let's practice it. And don't shout somebody down and just refuse to turn a deaf ear. Not if you mean it. And if you don't mean it, what are we doing here? So he was pretty much a realist and had a way of bringing them back to reality, I think.
I think both of you sound like you were really very realistic, and I think that sounds like a real important part of what you were trying to contribute was to
be
hands-on and be realistic about it.